It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Barrett.
The work of new media artist Hank Willis Thomas is being shown in the Milwaukee Art Museum's 30 Americans exhibit, which opens today.
Thomas uses art as a place to experiment with ideas about advertising, race, and history.
Branded Head is the name of one of the pieces by Hank Willis Thomas you'll see at the 30 Americans exhibit. Thomas also collaborated on the multi-platform work Question Bridge and was recently an independent scholar at Harvard's W.E.D. Du Bois Institute. Hank, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you so much.
Well, we're going to post a picture of one of your pieces that's on exhibit, Branded Head, on our Facebook page. But I'd love to hear in your own words what that work looks like, what it is.
Well, the image is called Branded Head, and it's a picture I took in 2003 of a person's head from a profile position, the backside of a bald African-American man's head. And he has a Nike swoosh branded on to his head. And it's an image I was using when I was really interested in talking about branding and commodity culture and the way that black male bodies have been kind of used in that context.
That's what's so unsettling about looking at that piece, is that this is this Nike swoosh that I grew up with. It's universally recognizable. It's kind of like the Coca-Cola symbol. But it's on somebody's head. It feels wrong. Is that what you're going for?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, if you look at some of the records of slave records in our country, and historically that, you know, a lot of slaves were branded as signs of ownership, and many of them were branded on their faces. So it's not that far-fetched.
Now, does the person in that image, does he have a story?
The actual person in that image, I mean, he's an artist and a collaborator of mine. But I actually, ironically, 3 years later, I happened to be in Cuba, of all places, and I did see someone with a brand, a Nike tattoo on his head. This case, it was photoshopped.
You got to wonder what's going on there that someone would put this brand icon on their body for free, probably.
Yeah, well, in a communist country of all places, too. I mean, I think a lot of these symbols, I think of logos as our era's hieroglyphs, and they're kind of embedded with a level of kind of potency and meaning that people really latch onto. And so we all actually, in a sense, do wear brands, especially on our feet. But, you know, our phones, our laptops, our cars are all kind of signifiers about who we are, what our values are.
So as an artist, when did you first start thinking about advertising and what it was telling us and what it was doing to us?
I think as a child, you know, I was always fascinated with the power of advertising and the ways in which kind of my interest was piqued. I thought it was kind of amazing, the kind of little stories that were told. It's only as I grew older that I realized some of the more, I wouldn't say sinister, but kind of manipulative aspects of it and kind of the values that were really imposed upon us when we kind of start to examine advertisements and kind of what's for sale and, you know, what's being sold.
Well, so you thought about this for a long time, and as someone who cares about this, you're working with it in your art, and you're thinking about what advertising is tossing out to the black population. Does advertising, do you think, reflect the stuff that we desire and how we want our lives to look, or does it actually create those desires in us?
Exactly. I think that's both. For me, I don't think, especially even if you look at advertisements that are might be seen on the surface to be marketed to an African-American population, they're actually frequently marketed to, you know, the greater public. But I'm interested in what happens when we do have target audiences, what kind of prejudices are kind of inherently exploited to make an advertisement for a specific audience, and kind of what kind of effects those have on the way that people in that audience see each other and themselves. I think of advertising almost as like a form of brainwashing and social conditioning.
How do you think that works? Like, what's the mechanism that advertising is able to niggle inside people's brains and actually make them act certain ways and believe certain things about themselves that may or may not be true?
Well, I guess the question is any of it true? I think what's happened, there's a really great, great documentary that the BBC did almost like 7 or 8 years ago called The Century of the Self, and it really kind of looks into the development of kind of public relations and how a lot of it has Freudian roots. And I think it's, you know, this incredible real social science that's kind of been developed around private industry that kind of has kind of used most of our greatest fears and desires in ways to kind of get us to purchase things and invest in things that we don't really need and probably don't really want, but feel more human, more desirable, more valuable once we attain these objects. And so when I look at advertisements, that's what I'm really interested in, kind of what kind of modes of seduction are at play there.
So you've cracked the code on advertising. You're someone who thinks about it, who kind of has gotten the chance through your art to strip away the artifice. But are you still a sucker for advertising? Is there a way to get away from that?
I mean, probably more than anyone else.
Are you wearing your Nikes and drinking Coca-Cola?
Yeah, exactly.
But I mean, you can't unbrand yourself.
That's the thing. I think I am still a part of the machine, and I'll probably never be outside of it. I've been conditioned in the society, and I'm really interested in how someone can really critique the system from within rather than trying to critique it from without. You know, I think it's really important that often in our society we are kind of expecting whenever someone's being critical that they have to be completely opposed to something or hate it or you know. And I really see myself as kind of a member of the society who's really just trying to shine a light on something that we take for granted that we probably shouldn't.
What does it mean for you to be part of this 30 Americans exhibition?
I'm still making sense of it because I think it'll be even more important 30 years from now than it is at the moment. You know what I mean? It's as far as I know, as far as anyone I've asked knows, the first multi-generational survey show of African-American contemporary artists, which is surprising that it would be the first, considering how long, you know, there have been a huge number of African-American artists working in the contemporary art realm. So I'm just really honored to be a part of that group and to have people who I looked up to as peers and to be hopefully, you know, someone that other artists and especially non-African-American artists just are people who are just like happen to be in a museum that they can see as a frame of reference for people talking about issues that are relevant to our current life.
Well, wish you well with that exhibit. And Hank, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you. It's been really fun.
Artist Hank Willis Thomas is featured in a new exhibit at the Milwaukee Art Museum opening today.
Coming up, we'll take a check of the latest news from Wisconsin. I'm Veronica Rickers.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Monday morning at 6, Joy Cardine and her guests look at a new study on the effects of distracted driving.
And here's Kristen Durst from the news department with a look at the latest headlines.
Thanks, Rob. The man accused of the 2009 shooting rampage at Fort Hood in Texas will have to come up with a new defense strategy. A military judge is refusing to let Major Nadal Hassan tell jurors that he opened fire on soldiers in order to protect the lives of Taliban leaders in Afghanistan. The shooting rampage left 13 people dead and nearly 3 dozen wounded. Authorities say a second victim has died after an explosion and fire at a South Louisiana chemical plant. Yesterday's blast injured dozens of others. The cause of the explosion isn't yet known. Federal environmental officials say work to clean up contamination in the Sheboygan River is finished. The river was listed as an area of concern in a list of toxic hotspots identified in the 1987 Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency released a statement today saying $80 million worth of dredging and habitat restoration projects needed to remove the designation have been completed.
You can hear more news coming up at 4:30. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll talk to an outdoor guide who says kids need to spend more time in nature, and it's okay to get dirty and take risks and have messy adventures in the rain.
Noah Ovchinsky joins us now for our weekly catch-up on state news. He's our assistant news director here at WPR. Noah, thanks for joining us.
Hey, good afternoon. How you all doing?
Pretty good. How are you today?
Excellent. It's Friday.
Well, the big news in Wisconsin this week, still ongoing today. It's getting a lot of national attention. The ultrasound bill, a bill on abortion, always controversial, Noah. What's the latest on that?
Very, very controversial and a divisive issue here in Wisconsin, as it is elsewhere. The legislature just passed, within the last 24 to 48 hours, just passed a bill that requires women to get an ultrasound before an abortion. There are exceptions for instances of rape or incest. But again, this is a very controversial piece of legislation, with lawmakers on both sides speaking very passionately and in some cases speaking very personally about this issue.
And what has been some of the reaction to this bill so far?
Yeah, I mean, of course, it generally falls down according to, you know, people who are pro-life and pro-choice. Of course, this is part of a larger effort around the country to put further restrictions on abortion, you know, short of course, making it illegal, which is very difficult to do, if not impossible, with the Supreme Court ruling. But it's part of a nationwide effort to slowly shrink the access, or put more requirements on both law, doctors, the other folks that work at clinics, as well as the patients themselves.
I want to dig into a couple of the specific details. There's one subset of the law that's related to a Planned Parenthood clinic in Appleton. What's going on there?
Yeah, basically, one of the other sort of pieces of legislation that has made their way around the country, really, is legislation that requires doctors to have admitting privileges to hospitals. And generally, it's within a certain distance of whatever clinic that they work at. And in this case, in Wisconsin, the law says that doctors working in abortion clinics have to have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles of a clinic. And, that is aimed at the Planned Parenthood clinic in Appleton, which, you know, may have to curtail services or even close because of that change.
And then there are a couple of related bills passed by the Assembly.
Yeah, they've passed the Assembly. They have not passed the Senate yet, but they've passed a bill banning health insurance coverage of abortions for state workers. And the other one lets people sue doctors if they think they performed what they call sex-selective abortions, which, evidence suggests isn't very common, of course, in our country, but is in other countries in India and China and so forth.
Those passed the Assembly. Any expectation of what happens when they go to the Senate?
No, I'm not a betting man, and I wouldn't lay down that bet.
Sure. Now, some of the other big news is campaign finance. Now, it looks like both parties a little bit agreed on something.
Wait, did you just say both parties agreed?
I know. Stop the presses.
This is as close to bipartisan as pretty much any piece of legislation is going to get these days in Madison. Essentially, what it does, it allows online registration, voter registration for Wisconsinites. And at the same time, it doubles the contribution limits that individuals can make to candidates. So it both expands people's ability to vote, but it also increases the amount of money that makes its way into the system.
And campaign finance advocates or reform advocates, I assume, are not happy with what's going on there?
No, because it's more money. it's more money in the system. People, of course, who support this measure will say that it may actually lead to greater transparency. There is some debate about that. But the one thing that I would say that was stripped from this legislation, which was part of it, which was a voter ID measure that required voters to have an ID when they vote. And that was, I guess, judged to be a tenuous vote at best. And so that was stripped from this measure. I guarantee you that if that voter ID part was in the legislation, it would not have been bipartisan, that's for sure.
Mike McCabe of Wisconsin Democracy Campaign will be on the Joy Cardine Show Monday at 7:30, I believe. Now let's look at some national legislation with a big impact on Wisconsin, the Farm Bill. This is a big deal. It's a big, complicated bill. What are some of the things we're most interested in here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, well, most interestingly, we've been actually operating under an extension of the former Farm Bill, which expired last year because of gridlock in Congress. We just haven't been able to get a full five-year farm bill passed. And what happened this week is the Senate passed their version of the farm bill. And the House is expected to vote on their version of the farm bill next week, in fact. And there are a few things that I think are really relevant to Wisconsinites. One, of course, is the very divisive issue of food stamp funding. A big part of the farm bill is actually food stamp funding. And there, of course, because, you know, sequestration and the sort of the attitude of cost cutting in Washington right now, people want to cut. They want to cut, cut, cut. And the Senate voted to cut $4 billion in the food stamp program. House Republicans want to cut around $20 billion. So there's a lot of ground to make up, and it remains to be seen whether or not they're going to be able to agree on how much money to cut from the food stamp program.
And then our eyes in Wisconsin are on what this means for the dairy industry, the new farm bill. What kind of changes are there?
Huge changes, actually, Rob. The federal government is contemplating a major change in the safety net for the nation's dairy farmers, including those farmers here in Wisconsin. And essentially what it does, and it's pretty complicated, but I'll try to water it down. It basically, it replaces the direct payments that and other supports that the government gives to farmers, essentially. And, you know, those direct payments aren't very popular. It's not very popular with farmers. It's not very popular with, you know, taxpayers because it's very expensive. And so what they are suggesting we do is create sort of an insurance program. So if, say, the operating margins of a dairy farm get too slim, which is essentially the difference between the cost of feed and milk prices, if that margin becomes too slim, that the government will come in and pay for insurance to help keep those those farmers afloat. And it basically just brings like the stability to what is a very it's an industry that, you know, deals with really huge fluctuations in the price of milk. This change in the safety net is very popular with small farmers. Other producers not so happy with it because in exchange for this insurance, which protects your business essentially, paid for by the taxpayer, you are required to shrink your herd, or rather stop producing milk if the government asks you to in order to stabilize prices. And that's very unpopular.
That's an issue we'll be keeping our eyes on in the weeks to come. Noah, thank you so much for joining us.
Yep, thanks guys.
Noah Ovshinsky is our assistant news director here at WPR.
Well, it's the end of the school year and the start of that other yearly ritual, the battle to get kids outside.
Yeah, there's a lot of temptation for kids to stay inside and for me to stay inside, too. Between the air conditioning, the TV, the video games, it's easy to have fun without stepping outside.
But our next guest says kids aren't getting outside as much as they should. He's a hiking, rafting, and climbing guide. He's worked with schools to create outdoor programs as well. And he's got lots of advice on how to get kids out the door and into nature. And we want to hear from you. Tell us how you get your family outside with a call to 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234.
Our guest is Peter Brown Hoffmeister. His new book is Let Them Be Eaten by Bears, a fearless guide to taking our kids into the great outdoors. Peter, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, before we get into how we get our kids outside, let's talk about why. What do kids lose if they're not spending time outdoors?
Well, basically, this book started in talking to editors and my friends and other parents. And basically, we just all feel like we've gotten away from our roots. And all of our technology has sealed us off from the natural world. So we have to go back and reclaim our place in the outdoors. Kind of that thing where parents used to say, just go outside and play. No rules, just the outdoors. And my friends and I just felt like, well, you know, we're not saying that anymore. We're not saying just go outside and play. And we're not really going outside ourselves either.
So what's changing for people, Peter? Why aren't people doing what maybe they grew up doing as a kid and getting kicked outside?
I mean, I think there are a lot of different things going on. A lot of it has to do with fear. I love Richard Louv's writing. I love that author. And, you know, he traces it back to maybe that viral rhyme Stranger Danger, you know, in the 1970s. And since then, actually, child abductions have gone down, but we feel like our world is more dangerous, at least in the neighborhood level, you know. So I think there's a lot of fear. But then there are just a lot more technological distractions, really. I mean, it's easy to watch movies, Netflix, TV. It's easy to be on the iPad or easy to play video games. I totally understand that. So it's a challenge to myself as much as a challenge to anybody else.
Peter, I'm a parent. I get that my kids should be outside. Yeah. But sometimes it just sounds like so much work. Where can I start that isn't a big production in just a minute or so now?
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing is that unstructured time in the outdoors is wonderful for creativity and adaptability. Studies have shown that over and over. So if we want vibrant, capable children, we need to give them outdoor unstructured time. So, I mean, just starting simple, that's the first place right there. Don't feel guilt. Don't feel like you have to create extraordinary and ever-changing nature experiences. As an outdoor program director of teens and a parent myself, I always say that it's good enough to just go outside. So start with opening that door, go walk, hike, ride bikes, catch bugs in your hands, play capture the flag, pick flowers. It doesn't really matter. Just start simple.
So it doesn't have to be high tech. It can just be, you know what, open the door, maybe take your shoes out, get a jar, put a bug in it, and that's a good starting point.
Exactly. I mean, you can climb small trees together, jump on a trampoline in the backyard, play tag or catch. You know, I have friends who live in New York City, and so they do park tours where they visit each park in the city, and they go back to their favorites, and they check them off on a map. So it doesn't have to be complicated. You could build sandcastles in a sandbox or get cheap fishing poles and fish a local pond or canoe a slough, or if you have a butte, hike that butte.
Well, we'll get more on that when we come back as we talk with Peter Braun Hofmeister as he stays with us. And we want to hear from you. Did you spend your childhood outside? Do you get your kids out in nature right now? And if you don't, what's holding you back? Call us at 1-800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our discussion with Peter Braun Hofmeister, the author of Let Them Be Eaten by Bears. He says we should make an effort to get kids outside and out into nature. You can join in our conversation right now. We'd love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. Tell us if you're finding a good way to get your kids out into nature. Are you encountering resistance, and how are you overcoming that? Email us at talk@WPR.org, or you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Peter, you've worked with kids in school programs, groups of kids. How do you see children change when they get out of their indoor comfort zone and they just experience nature?
I see kids relaxing. I see that nature is especially good for kids who are suffering from ADD or ADHD or anxiety disorders. I love how nature is just what it is. It's very simple. A rock is a rock and a tree is a tree. And there's no manipulation. So it's just a little bit, although nature is really complex, it's less complex for them because there's no social complexity. So I definitely see kids just doing better overall. And some of that is on a chemical level. When I was researching for this book, I found studies that prove that dirt has bacteria that activate the neurons that produce serotonin, a natural antidepressant. So dirt on the skin makes us happy on a chemical level. Therefore, we have to let kids get dirty, and kids love to get dirty, so that works, you know.
Wow, so dirt makes you happier. Who knew?
Yeah. And sun, I also found, I live in Eugene, Oregon, so it's not very sunny in the winter, but I found out that a half hour of sunlight, even filtered sunlight through clouds in the winter, makes us sleep better, digest better, gives us more energy, and helps us perform better on mental tasks. And I, you know, working with teens in my outdoor program and then seeing this with my daughters, backpacking on snowshoes in the winter, that sunlight, even that winter sunlight, really affects us in a positive way.
Peter, what if you have the best intentions and you've read the Richard Liu book about getting kids into the woods, but you're just, you know, you're kind of a chicken and it seems scary to be alone in the woods in a tent and do the stuff that the real outdoorsy parents, people, for instance, like you, are doing. What if you need to find your courage?
That's such a great question. I don't know if there's real and unreal nature people or nature parents or something. I just think don't feel guilty. Keep it simple. Really, you know, think what's most important here. And what's most important for me is just spending time with our kids and going outside. So it does not have to be complex. I mean, I love to camp with my girls and I love to rock climb with my girls, but I love to also just bike around the neighborhood with them, you know. And so it doesn't have to be crazy. And if you lower your expectations, you're probably going to be able to succeed a little bit more. So I think, like, high expectations means high disappointment. And low expectations you can kind of meet. So start small.
Phil in Madison is on the air with us now at 800-642-1234. Phil, hi.
Hi.
What's your outdoor story?
We've got a couple, but the one that we enjoy the most is I've got two boys, 8 and 10 years old, and we actually mountain bike as a family. Wisconsin has one of the largest outdoor mountain bike series competitive events. It's actually one of the few competitive events you can do as a family, right? You see a lot of other kids, you know, maybe playing soccer or baseball, but you can't really participate with them. So the Wars races, there's actually one coming up here on Sunday in Cambridge, Wisconsin, and I'm doing the race with my 10-year-old at different competitive levels.
That sounds like a lot of fun, Phil. And how do your kids react to that?
Oh, they love the outdoors. And it doesn't have to be organized. The other story we have is my wife and I were commenting on what their favorite toys are, and literally their favorite toys are sticks, twigs, and string. So they can, you know, make whatever they want to on the outside, whether it be forts or what have you, and they don't need, you know, official toys.
Phil, so, thank you so much for the call. And, Peter, getting out there as a family, how important is that?
Oh, it's so important. And that's such a great story with the sticks. I mean, I love that stick book, too. But I love watching my 8-year-old daughter, and she'll just play with pine cones and sticks for hours, and suddenly they're princesses and princes and dragons, and they're flying. And it's so true that kids really don't need much as far as toys go.
Do you find that when kids are outside, that something about that just kicks their imagination into overdrive and the stories start flowing?
Yes, definitely. Every study I've read, it's has shown that the outdoors and spending time outside, you know, raises your creativity and adaptability. And adaptability is the number one survival skill, according to pretty much every survival book you're going to read. So I definitely see that. And with creativity leading to stories, there's so many good times to tell stories. I was spelunking in a cave in Lavitude in Central Oregon with some high school kids last fall. And we went into this far back room, and one of the high school girls said, "Let's turn off our headlamps." And so we turned off our headlamps, and then this boy started a story, and we just each added a sentence to it and went around the circle and just kept adding to the story for about an hour. And I thought, you know, I don't know if this would happen if we weren't in the dark in a cave, you know, with the lights off. So I definitely think there are opportunities for stories outside.
We've got a comment here from Tyler on Facebook who says, "All my nieces and nephews have iPads, and it's hard to get them out. Personally, I'd be happy if they just took the iPads outside." That would be a baby step. But, I mean, just like decoupling the kid from the electronic device, that can be so hard. Peter, how do you convince them to just put down the iPad or whatever it is and go outside? Do you have any double secret outdoorsy guy techniques?
That's a tough one because it's really easy if the video game's violent and then we're saying, okay, well, I'm not going to let my kid play that and you just take it out of their hands. But if you're going to trade them for something, you know, you have to make it fun, and that's tough. One thing that always helps in the outdoors is taking really good food. Kids love good food. So, I mean, if you take really good food out and you're like, hey, we're going to eat this and this while we go explore, they're likely to go explore. The other thing is letting the kids lead. So, for example, I always say we explore, we don't hike. So see where they go, allow them autonomy, and, you know, just let them go. And then getting dirty again, we say the mantra, there is no bad weather, only inappropriate clothing. And so let them get wet, let them splash in the rain puddle, let them collect worms and do worm rescue or whatever they want to do.
Peter, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That was Peter Brown Hoffmeister, author of Let Them Be Eaten by Bears. Now you can keep sharing your stories. Were you just inspired by Peter? Let us know what you're going to get out and do this weekend, whether you have kids, whether you are a kid, or you're just going to head out by yourself or with some friends. Go to the Central Time Facebook page and share your upcoming outdoor adventure, or maybe your best outdoor adventure ever at the Central Time Facebook page.
Rob, what are you going to do?
I don't know. I've got to think. I think we'll just get out for a walk.
Baby steps. Yeah. I think we're going to do a picnic. That kind of counts with good food. Good food, just like Peter said. And coming up, we'll talk about the implications of yesterday's Supreme Court ruling that says human genes cannot be patented. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Monday at 3, John Munson talks to a reporter about the CIA's new role in the way America wages war against terrorist groups. You'll hear that on At Issue, Monday at 3.
And here's a look at the latest headlines with WPR News reporter Kristen Durst.
Thanks a lot, Veronica. Voting has ended in Iran's presidential election. Iranians have waited in line for hours in wilting heat at some polling stations in downtown Tehran and other cities. Voting was extended by 5 hours there. A transit police officer who survived a showdown with the Boston Marathon bombing suspects has been discharged from the hospital. Officer Richard Donahue headed home this morning with other Massachusetts Bay Transportation Authority officers escorting him. He still has a bullet in his body, has been coping with nerve damage that makes it painful to walk. A gun rights group has filed a lawsuit against Republican Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen, alleging his state Justice Department's concealed carry rules limit training class sizes. The rules require concealed carry permit applicants to show proof they've taken a hunter safety course, been discharged from the military, or an instructor-led firearms course. Waukesha-based Wisconsin Carry filed a lawsuit contending its training courses routinely exceed the student-instructor ratios.
Thanks, Kristen. You can hear more news coming up at 5 o'clock. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Yesterday, the Supreme Court ruled unanimously that human genes cannot be patented.
Some are saying the decision will lower the cost of genetic testing for certain health risks like breast cancer, but others claim the ruling will discourage investment in some key areas of medical research.
Here to explain what the Supreme Court's decision means for you is Shobita Parthasarathy. She's professor of public policy at the University of Michigan. Welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Good afternoon.
Well, so what is the case that led to this Supreme Court decision?
Sure. So it was a case brought by a coalition of scientists, physicians, and patients represented by the American Civil Liberties Union. And that's actually really significant because this was the first time that this kind of public interest-based challenge occurred in the context of the patent system. And basically what they did was they questioned whether or not specifically genes linked to breast and ovarian cancer, known as the BRCA genes, were patentable. And the question that the Supreme Court then eventually asked was whether or not human genes, broadly speaking, are quote-unquote products of nature. And basically, there's a loophole in patent law that if something is basically a product of nature, then it can't be patentable. So the question here was really specifically, are human genes isolated from the body products of nature? And if so, that means they're not patentable. And that's essentially what the Supreme Court decided yesterday.
Now, a lot of our eyes may not light up when we hear patent law. And this sounds a little bit philosophical, too. But the reason this challenge was brought, right, was because there's an idea that this had an impact on how we actually get health care and how much it costs us.
Yeah, it really enormously did, in that the company that holds the patent on this isolated BRCA gene, used it essentially to shut down research in the United States and also to become the sole provider of genetic testing for breast and ovarian cancer. And what that meant was it offered a very expensive test, about $3,000, and it was the only one offering that test. So women who were concerned about their risk had nowhere else to go if they wanted a second opinion. And this actually was an important issue because it turned out at one stage that their test was inadequate, but nobody else in the U.S. was doing that research to find out what the problem was or offering an alternative test. It was only actually French scientists who figured that out, and eventually the U.S. company incorporated that into the test. So, you know, for a long time, well, the only test available in the U.S. was an inferior test that had some serious problems.
And this is a test that's led some people to make very big life decisions, up to and including double mastectomies, right?
That's right. I mean, so the only sort of the most, the best thing you can do if you have a significant risk of breast and ovarian cancer, unfortunately, is either removal of breast, of your breasts and or your ovaries. And that's a really brutal thing. It has, of course, enormous medical effects and psychological effects. So these are very serious decisions that women have to make on the basis of these test results.
And before somebody does this, maybe they're thinking, I would really like a second opinion.
Exactly.
And they couldn't
yeah.
get it right
and
under the current system.
Unfortunately, that wasn't really available.
Now, companies who do this kind of research, who wanted to make these kind of patents, are saying, hey, this is like medicine. We're putting a lot of money into this. To give us an incentive to do that, we need to know that we can make money when we're done with it. A lot of this is uncertain. This research may not lead anywhere. When we get a hit, we need to make money, and now we're not going to be able to, so this good research isn't going to happen.
Right. So there are sort of two things, I think, that I would say in response to that. The first is actually that the breast cancer genetics case is itself an alternative case to that. That is that there were a number of scientists involved in this research, and if myriad, it was only sort of a matter of days or weeks in terms of who found the gene. So there were actually tons of people doing this research, and the reason that is because there are all kinds of incentives to do research. University scientists, for example, might get tenure on the basis of the things that they do research on and publish. There might be prestige involved. You can imagine there would be in the case of breast and ovarian cancer, for example. So there are a number of incentives, and we often forget that in terms of doing research. The second thing I think is very important to remember is that even without gene patents, we can still get patents on a wide variety of things. So patents are still allowed on the methods of doing novel ways of genetic testing, developing therapies, genetic therapies themselves, the tailored genetic therapies are still patentable. And in fact, even the Supreme Court in its decision yesterday said that what's called complementary DNA. So if you do just a little bit more work than simply isolating the DNA from the body, that is also patentable. So there are lots of ways in which researchers can use intellectual property rights to protect their work and to provide an incentive.
Now, it sounds to me like this would be a big deal if it were only about these breast cancer genes, but this kind of genetic, maybe personalized medical treatment, is that the wave of the future?
Well, that's what people are saying, and that's what makes this case even more important, because it removes essentially an important barrier to research in healthcare. A number of scientists were saying that they were worried about getting involved in this area of research because they were worried about the patent environment and the endless litigation that might erupt if they were thought to be infringing on somebody's patents. It stifled the number of innovators and therefore, you know, the possibilities of access to healthcare and the possibilities that we're hoping for in terms of the future of personalized medicine, that we could actually get to a point where we could tailor drugs to an individual's genetic makeup. And the problem was, if all of that was caught up in this, in patents, it would be very difficult for a wide variety of people to do the kinds of research to develop this very sensitive kind of sort of next generation of medicine.
Now, I don't want to ask anybody to predict the future, but predict the future. What is this case going to mean now? What are institutions, what are healthcare facilities going to start doing now that this decision is in place?
Well, specifically, basically, when it comes to breast cancer and breast cancer genetic risk, already in the last 24 hours, a number of scientists and testing providers have said that they're going to start doing research or offering tests in the tests on the breast cancer genes. So, and I think you're going to see that kind of ripple effect around sort of genetic testing and genetic research. I think that means good things, as I said, for personalized medicine. I think the other thing that I would argue is that it's very good for innovation. So this is a really landmark case in a wide variety of ways, but one of which is that the Supreme Court is really saying that there should be limits to what we patent. There's a delicate balance in terms of a patent system that really stimulates innovation and one that ends up stifling it. And this is the first time in many, many years in such a big case that it's really saying, wait a second, I think we're sort of erring on the side of patents stifling innovation. Let's take a step back. And so I think it could start to change our sort of science and technology environment even more generally, where people are saying, you know what, there are other ways in which we can innovate, think about business strategies to promote innovation that aren't so reliant on our patent strategies.
Well, thanks for taking it there, because I did want to bring that up. There's been a lot of talk in the tech industry, right, about if I want to innovate, if I want to make up something new, I have to clear 20, 40, 100 patents on every micro step of the new permutation that I'm doing. Is that really a drag on innovation?
Certainly, that's in the sort of information technology arena. It's so much a drag on innovation that companies, large companies like IBM, for example, are saying, you know what, we don't want to participate in this patent game anymore. It is really problematic because technology is moving so quickly. In biotechnology, it has been a drag as well, but there's been less of a move toward, you know, sort of giving up patentability, in part, I think, because of the legacy of the pharmaceutical industry, where I think the pharmaceutical industry sees patents as very important. And since the biotech industry kind of built on that, there's been a strong reliance on patents. But I really think that that's going to change now. While this is the largest scale decision of its kind, in the last few years, the Supreme Court, I think, has been sending a very strong signal that it's sort of reached the tipping point and that universities and companies really need to start rethinking how they engage in innovation and how they think about monetizing their research and improving their bottom line, and that patents are actually doing a disservice to innovators.
Well, but where's this impetus going to come from? This isn't, I can't see somebody running for Congress under the banner of patent reform, you know, and getting people really fired up at a rally on that one.
No, that is absolutely true. And, I've been working in this area for many years, and I think, you know, this is such an important area, but it's a hard case to make. But I think that's why this is a really important case. As I said, this was a unique case in that it was a public interest challenge. And it really took a public interest angle to force change in the system. In the early days of this case, people really saw it as a nuisance. And while, you know, in the sort of coverage of the case in the last couple of days, you've seen really big figures come out in support, that was not the case in the beginning, because it was really total outsiders to the system who said, you know, there's a problem here. And I'll also say in the coverage, you know, if you look at the New York Times articles on this that have been published in the last couple of days, and you look at the comments, the public is kind of overwhelmingly against this expansion in the patent system. So my take on it is that the public is becoming sensitized to the problems of the patent system. They're seeing that they're really significant. And I think that challenge is actually going to have to come from these kinds of grassroots public interest challenges. And we are actually seeing them more and more. There are groups now just focused on challenging the patent system in terms of a grassroots base. And I think that's likely to be the course of action, because, as you said, it's not necessarily seen as a sexy topic. And I also think that the patent office and the courts that are focused on patents, they're not going to be the ones to engage in change either. So it really has to come from everyday citizens who are sort of realizing how important this issue is and advocating to make a change. And that's worked in this case. So it suggests that there's some hope.
Thanks so much for joining us today.
Yep, Sure.
That was Shobita Parthasarathi, professor of public policy at the University of Michigan.
And thanks so much for listening to our program. And now we want to get your take.
Send us your thoughts about the new show and your suggestions. You can email listener@WPR.org or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Our producers are Chris Molina, Amanda Magnus, Galen Druk, and KP Whaley.
Michelle Good is our board operator, and Cheryl Gasser is the executive producer. We had engineering help from Brittany True and Brad Kohlberg. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Have a great weekend. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.